Many forms of self-expression today on Scribble.
Welcome to Scribble, 30 minutes of conversation, comments, and reviews on reading and writing, editing, publishing, and selling books. I'm Roald Tweet.
And I'm Don Wooten. Mark Schwiebert has written in several different formats. We'll ask him why on Scribble. Okay, Mark, you show up as a poet, a novelist, a columnist. What's going on? Why do you keep writing?
I must have been influenced by somebody by the name of Don Wooten to do all these different things.
Stop it.
Have you always done that?
I didn't do the columns really very much while I was mayor for the 20 years I did that. But after leaving that, I was asked by the Argus Dispatch to consider being a guest columnist. And I started doing that and sort of got into the habit of been doing it periodically ever since, usually no more than once a month. Don't want to wear out the welcome. But I try to deal with topics that I think are, you know, of timely concern, either of national or local interest. And hopefully they hit a responsive chord with some of the public.
Oh, well, you know, you've got to get letters to the editor.
Yeah.
I'm good at that.
Yep. Well, you do a weekly column, and I'm impressed by that because that takes a certain amount of imagination and discipline to put that together once a week.
I've talked about this before, but I commiserated with Murray Hurt when he had to write a daily column, and he said, I think writing a weekly column is tougher because you have to decide what to write about. He says, I have no choice. I just write about whatever I see every day.
Right.
And it is true. The hardest thing is to decide what to write about.
Yeah.
So many things float in your head all week long, and then you sit down at the computer, and now's the time, so let's see what comes out.
Sure.
And sometimes I'm surprised.
would you say a lot of people know you as a politician, not only just as the mayor of Rock Island, but interested in also in local politics, that your interest in whatever kind of writing you do always somewhere has a political edge?
Well, I think it does, especially in this day and age when there's so much going on and so many things going so wrong. Of course, the pandemic is on top of mind for a lot of people right now. But before that, the issue of the environment and all of the things that are going wrong with that and that really require just immediate and serious attention and unfortunately under the current administration have really been backburnered. So those things, I think, are things that stimulate it. And, of course, the whole situation more recently with the Black Lives Matter movement and the concerns that surfaced about the underlying racism that still infects so much of American life and that we really need to come to grips with. It's unfortunate it took George Floyd's death to bring that to a head. But I think because of the vividness and the graphicness of how he was killed, that really brought a lot of people's attention, focused a lot of people's attention, and is moving us in a direction that we've needed to go for a long time to deal with this original sin of America, which is racism.
I think the thing that stunned people was the casual way in which he was killed.
Mm-hmm.
The cop just knelt on his neck, paid no attention to what he was saying, glanced around at people who were yelling at him, and just did it.
Yeah. And I think, you know, having been in government and a mayor for a number of years and working with the police department and respecting very much all of what they do and the difficult job they have, one of the things we were always mindful of is the importance of making sure that a person who's given a badge and a gun, which is and veiled with the authority of the state, understands the responsibility that goes with that. And that's where we got into things like community policing, where you'd have police officers meeting with neighborhood groups as opposed to just driving through the neighborhood in the black and white squad car, where we were focusing on things like conflict de-escalation, all these kinds of things which could have been largely, you know, could have avoided the kinds of problems that we've seen. But it's a major issue, and we simply have to get a handle on it. And this hopefully will focus our attention on that, just like the pandemic's focused our need to focus our attention on science and fact as opposed to fiction and bluster, and also and getting back to dealing with the environment.
You know, you got back to the environment on your novel. What prompted that?
Well, you know, back in 2005, shortly after Al Gore's movie came out, An Inconvenient Truth, I started looking into it more deeply and realized just how so many of those trends that you look at in terms of the environment were all going the wrong way. Population was increasing way faster than the planet can really sustain. Consumption rate on our planet of the natural resources was way out of whack, and the amount of waste that we're generating was so large. So as a city, we started looking at some things we could do about it. We put together what was called the Advanced Technology and Sustainability Consortium that brought businesses involved with high-tech and environmental planning together on a regular basis. We bought a hydro plant, which we had hoped would save between 25 and 30% of our city's energy needs. Unfortunately, with high water because of climate change, it hasn't really worked out that way. It's become a liability. But we did a number of other things. And then when I left office, I said, you know, I've got to continue on with this. And I had come up with some ideas during that period from 2005 to 2008. And I thought, you know, I've got to put these in some kind of a form. And I figured that a book, a novel, would be the way to make it more palatable. By putting it in the context of a murder mystery, the template, A Parable of the Environment, basically takes off on the mysterious death of a former president who's been very involved with the environmental movement and the FBI's investigation under its lead investigator, a guy by the name of Derek Bone, to try to figure out what actually happened, because the circumstances just don't make sense. And as the story unfolds through a series of flashbacks, I go back to some of the things that this former president by the name of Joshua Johnson did to try to move us in the direction of being more responsible with the environment around us. And one of the key things was this template, which is a four-part test by which we would evaluate all products and processes to see if they were environmentally responsible or weren't. And that's kind of what the book is about. So it's a way of sort of putting a little... Well, we used to have a little dog, Goldie, and when we'd want to give him some medicine or something, we'd always wrap it in a little bacon, and that made it go down a lot easier. And I think in the same way, if you're dealing with ideas about the environment and some kind of abstract things, it can make it a little more palatable if you wrap it in a murder mystery. So that's what this did, and that's how it came to be.
Well, when I first got a copy just after you'd written it, I confess that was my worry, that this was going to be a diatribe on the environment made easier to swallow by done in fictional form. And that can be really deadly for a piece of fiction, mm-hmm. right? No man can serve two masters. But it turns out that this is also a darn good mystery. And I think you've been true to the novel part of it as much as you've been true to the environmental part.
Well, appreciate
and
that.
So I got to wondering if, in the course of writing it, did what you intended to say about the environment change given the demands of the novel, where the novel was going?
Well, the ideas were pretty well fixed at the time. I had the template pretty well formulated and a number of other ideas about the environment that I wanted to work into it. How I worked them in, you know, in what portion of the novel, that probably would have been the thing that kind of unfolded. Some people write fiction having a general idea of what the story is going to be, and then they jump into it and they let the story lead them. I had a pretty good idea of how I wanted the story to unfold, but you're right that as you write something, the characters sometimes take on a personality of their own.
Well, they should, I think, in a good piece of writing.
Yeah. And hopefully this did, and the characters were fairly plausible. Go ahead.
I'm intrigued by the subtitle, A Parable.
Right.
What? Why a parable?
Well, that's an interesting question. When we think of parables, we think of the parables of the New Testament, where Jesus would teach a lesson by using examples of people. You know, the so-called the Good Samaritan,
right,
or the prodigal son. And in this, it really was a tale that was intended to illustrate how, by neglecting the environment, we pay serious, serious consequences. And throughout this, the thing that focuses people's attention on embracing these ideas this former president has are a series of crises that keep mounting around the world. Tropical storms inundating whole coastal areas, major cities being flooded, not unlike the flood we had in New York City back in 2005, or Hurricane Katrina. And then mounting health care crises, which is kind of ironic considering what we're faced with the pandemic now. In the book, we're talking about malaria striking parts of the Midwest, something you usually associate with tropical areas. Well, of course, today we're seeing this pandemic sweeping the world. And in some respects, the scientists are telling us it's because of our encroaching on nature and our coming in contact with animals that we weren't in contact with before, and they're carrying viruses that we don't have a resistance to. So
more coming, too, I fear.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I think there's no question about it. It's one of these situations where you don't like to be the person who said, I told you so, but there are a lot of scientists who are able to say that now that have been forecasting we were going to have a pandemic like this 10 or 15 years ago, and we just didn't prepare for it.
Earlier you put out a book of poetry. Then you moved to a novel. You're doing columns. Do you just like variety? Is that it?
Well, that's a good question, Don. I think what it really comes down to is I think there are different ways you can communicate, and some of them are a little more straight up. You know, a column is pretty straightforward. You've got a topic you're dealing with, and you deal with that topic in a kind of a linear fashion. A novel is a little more abstract because you're illustrating principles by fictitious characters. Poetry is probably the most abstract of all because there you're oftentimes trying in a few words to capture the essence of something that in prose you would use a lot more words to describe and be a lot more literal with. So I think each of them gives you a little bit different way to express yourself, and that's what I'm attempting to do, is to give expression to those things that move me and hopefully can move others as well.
Well, you also do art. I mean, I've seen art exhibits by Mark Schwiebert at the Rock Island Public Library. Does the art have a message content too?
Yes, probably a little bit less, I used the term earlier, political. For example, on these last few trips we've taken, we took one to Africa a year ago, and this last spring we were in South America and the Galapagos and the Inca sites in Peru. I would say that yes, what I've been doing then is a series of paintings based on those trips, and those can be based on some of the landscapes. I think the objective is more to give expression to some of the beauty of the place, as opposed to poetry, which may be intended to capture more the essence of something spiritually.
You know, it is interesting that you feel compelled to express yourself in a variety of ways, but at the core of it is the drive to express yourself.
Mm-hmm.
That is interesting. And that is a very human thing, particularly in very self-aware humans, that you absorb all the stuff around you and you have to express it to be, in a sense, a teacher. And I think that quite often is at the heart of it, that you want to teach. You want to share what you've enjoyed and to share what you know. And the idea that this has either given you great delight or pause, and you want other people to share with that. Is that fair?
Yeah, I think that is. There was something said by Oliver Wendell Holmes years ago in which he observed that how sad it was for a person to die with their music inside them. And I thought, that's really eloquent. That you've been given gifts of insight or understanding through teaching, through experiences. And I think one of our responsibilities as a human being is to share those insights that we've garnered through the influence of others and in our own experiences to enrich the experiences of those around us. So much as Roald, you as a professor at Augustana, and Don, you as a state senator and as a director of a public radio station, are in the business of sharing information and insights, I view that as kind of being a human responsibility each of us has, so we don't let the music inside of us die.
That's a very good statement, and I agree with that. I only wish I had a little more energy.
Well, let's hear both some of your poetry and from the template. Your choice which to go first.
Well, let's do the template first. Now, I'm going to just read a short segment here that picks up in the story. As I mentioned before, the story is about the murder, the suspicious death that turns out to be a murder of a former president by the name of Joshua Johnson. And this section I'm going to read picks up where the detective in charge of the investigation, Derek Bone, has contacted the president's former assistant, a woman by the name of Dr. Lydia Stonecraft, to try to get her insights into what might have happened surrounding the death of Johnson. So I'll pick up at that point. Bone's call found her bereft. Given his nature and the stage of the investigation, naturally, Bone pushed forward anyway. Dr. Stonecraft, I understand your loss at the death of President Johnson, but I need to ask you about events leading up to his death at Friendship Point. She seemed oddly comforted that inquiries were being made by the FBI. I'll try to help, she said, though it just doesn't seem real that he's gone. He was so full of life and, well, physically vigorous until the moment of his death, she reflected. Well, that's partly why we're looking into this. Can you tell me what the two of you talked about the afternoon before he died? Well, a lot of things we usually discussed. How progress was going with getting the goals of the Global Summit clarified and agreed upon. How work on adoption of the template was progressing. Now, tell me about that. I've heard reference in the press to the template, but I'll be frank with you, I hadn't paid a whole lot of attention until the president died. You should have, she responded earnestly. It was a set of standards President Johnson crafted to reshape the way we deal with the environment of the world around us, from man-made to natural habitats. Pretty controversial stuff, I suppose, Agent Bone prompted. Of course. There was enormous opposition at first, from OPEC to car manufacturers to big retailers who saw the template undercutting their whole way of doing business. She paused. But in spite of that, it seemed to be catching on. People seemed to be getting it. What we do have to change. That what we do has to change if we want to live, go on living on our planet with any semblance of the quality of life we've known for our children. She paused again. Bone was interested, but focused on his investigation. So anyone in particular you think wouldn't get it, as you put it, who would want to harm the former president? Oh, I'm sure there are a lot of people like that out there. But right now, I'm having a hard time getting my brain around Joshua's being gone, much less who would have had a motive in making it happen. I'm sorry. She started to cry. Bone decided to wrap things up. I understand, doctor. Thanks for talking. I may be back in touch. In the meantime, if you think of anything else or need to talk, call me. He gave her his cell phone number. It was his turn to pause. Something inside prompted him to add, and again, I'm very sorry for your loss. The whole world will be sorry, she sighed softly as she hung up.
Uh-huh.
You read well, too.
Yeah.
Little experience.
Apparently he built a park, too. I don't know.
Now you've got a poem.
Well, this was actually one that was written on our trip to South America, and I was so struck by the Galapagos, which are, of course, the place where Charles Darwin was inspired with the things that led to the origin of the species, which really changed our whole scientific understanding of the world around us and kind of ties in with the environment. So the title of this poem is Galapagos Wonderland. From arid coastal plains of harsh barrenness to lush highlands redolent of living green, from iguanas glowering beneath cacti to soaring frigate birds swooping to pirate their prey, Lewis Carroll could hardly conjure such a place, where what is what it is one place and not another. A radiant, fanciful wonderland of contrast that teaches not only lessons of survival and adaptation, but of nature's interdependence as well. How ironic that this place, isolated from others by geography and circumstance and so long scorned by humanity for its seeming desolation, should be the seedbed of ecological abundance, which from its very isolation could spawn such divergence of species as to inspire Darwin's discovery that set the world on fire, with insights to reshape science and bedevil humanity with its misunderstanding. Yet in this place we now likewise see evolution of another life, of waste-free energy and habitat restored, of pride bent to climate's necessity and consumption yielding to conservation that preserves life's vital treasures, of a diversity that once stirred Darwin's imagination, now inspiring us and others to lend our hands in nature's regeneration.
Well, you don't give up pushing your agenda, I'll say that.
This is a little aside, but a bunch of students were over at our living room one night, and I don't know how the talk turned to the Galapagos, but we actually got a map out and discovered that if you went directly south from our living room, you would hit the Galapagos.
Really?
Exactly. Yeah. So several students were going to go. Well, yeah. Let's take a bus to New Orleans and we'll figure out a way of getting in. It never amounted to anything, but the Galapagos is exactly south of us.
And it's right on the equator, literally directly on the equator.
Yeah.
You know, that's very good. I am amazed at how you can turn all these things about which you think and about which you feel deeply into various forms and succeed at all of them. It's not fair, Mark. It's not, but,
well,
you know, we've talked to some lawyers who turn to writing mysteries. Is that a thing?
Well, some have done pretty well at it. If you look at Scott Turow and John Grisham.
Grisham,
they've made a decent living at it. I don't know. I think that probably because lawyers are sort of wordsmiths, professionally we shape words, we use words, and we frame them in a way that's hopefully persuasive, that it's a natural transfer from one to the other. It's kind of fun. I haven't done much fiction. I don't read a lot of fiction. I read mostly nonfiction, which probably doesn't come as any surprise to either of you, but I enjoy historical fiction, and I do recognize it as being a really valuable tool for trying to communicate ideas, and hopefully the template did that in some way.
So where do we get a copy of the template?
Well, it's actually available on just about any of the major distributors, Amazon, okay. Google. You can access it on any of those. It's available in, I'm not that technologically sophisticated, online format or the print format. But I think the key thing for me is to get the ideas out in place, because it does have a number of kind of interesting ideas in it of things that could really change the way we deal with the environment around us, from how we use all the salt water on this planet to meet our shortened water needs to ways that we can work cooperatively to bend the curve on our overconsumption and overgeneration of waste, as well as overpopulation, which is a huge issue we're having to deal with.
You know, there are so many problems. As I've said before, it doesn't seem fair that all these things get loaded on us at once. And our real difficulty is we seem in the news and in public attention to be able to deal with only one at a time. Right now, the pandemic has just swamped everything. And it's a wonderful curtain behind which to dismantle government and do all sorts of mischievous things which are occurring in Washington, because our attention is focused elsewhere. Mm-hmm. And yet, we can't afford to forget the climate problem. We can't afford to forget the overpopulation problem.
Right.
The sheer difficulty, we have enough food, we can't distribute it. We can't find a reasonable means of doing that. How do you deal with all that?
Well, I think what I've always found useful is try to look for connections. Look for things that can work together to resolve the problem, if you know you've got one like that. For example, when it comes to the pandemic, that has really focused our attention on the need for effective government. I mean, it's astonishing that with the U.S. representing 4% of the world's population, we now have over 50% of the COVID cases in the world here in the United States, a developed country. We're right up there with Brazil and Russia in terms of COVID infections, only ours is higher. We're in such bad shape now that the European Union is looking not at allowing U.S. citizens to travel to Europe because of the risk that we carry with us. I mean, it just shows the importance of effective national leadership or the price of not having that national leadership. So where does that lead? That leads to potentially an opportunity this November to make some changes where we will have a new government that can come in and can start asserting a role in some of these things. The pandemic ties in with the environment. The environment ties in with population. These things are interconnected. We have to look at those interconnections and then appeal to people's common interest. I mean, none of us wants our loved ones to be infected with COVID any more than we want ourselves to be infected. There's a basic primal interest to try to avoid that. But we need to appeal to the selflessness in folks of saying it's not only in your self-interest, but in the interest of your loved ones and your community to make this better. I have great hope for humanity because one of our primary focuses, one of our primary driving forces is the desire to be useful, the desire to be needed, the desire to be loved. And that's something we haven't been tapping into for a long time in government, and it's something we need to get back to, the desire to be helpful.
We've also been cultivating a climate of selfishness and greed.
That's the other part of our human nature. And for the last 50 years or so in this country, that's what's been getting the attention. And we need to get away from that. I grew up in the generation, and you did too, where we had John F. Kennedy say, ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country. And it resonated with people. People stood up and saluted at that. Then there came a leadership that said, greed is good. And that, what's my government done for me lately? And that's been the mode we've been in for a long period of time, basically the last 50 years. It's time for that to change. And I think we're at a watershed moment in our country that we're hearing a lot of talk now about a Green New Deal. The undercurrent there is the New Deal in Franklin Roosevelt, and I think we're going to see more appeal to that going forward. And that whole concept that was implicit in the New Deal in the 1930s was, what unites us? What brings us together? How can we solve these problems for the common good? Focusing on the common good. That's what FDR was so good at, and that's what we need to get back to.
Let me suggest an audience, Mark, that will actually really listen to you. Children. What about a children's book?
Yeah,
they do take it seriously.
Actually, I've written a couple of kind of short works on that subject, and one of them is Perry the Potterer and his money machine, and he makes this money machine which allows him to buy everything around him, and he pretty soon owns everything, and discovers that instead of being happy, he's isolated and pretty much resented and despised by everybody around him. And the thing that first gave him pleasure, which was puttering with things, which led him to invent this machine, leads him to ultimately destroy the machine because he realizes that's not where his happiness comes from. Greed does not bring happiness.
Again, you're ahead of me.
Okay.
I do remember, however, the first time that I was aware you were political, you were student body president at Augustana. And I believe it was 1971. Were you president then?
71 to 72.
Okay. The student government took a straw poll among students about what we should do with Vietnam. Should we get out? Should we maintain the status quo? Or should we accelerate? And the winner by a clear margin was accelerate.
Yeah. And if you take in that poll.
And there's a faculty that was pretty much liberal.
Yeah. And do that same poll 5 years later.
Yeah.
Well, you know, this has been a very interesting session, Mark, and I do appreciate it, but time will make its demands, and we must bow out of here. But thank you very much.
My pleasure.
For spending time with us. I'm Don Wooten with Roll Tweet. This has been another session of Scribble. We'll make a stab at it again next week and hope you will join us.